Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to This Miraculous Life. Broadcasting and recording live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Oliveri Olumba, and this podcast is all about tuning in with the miraculousness of life and liberating ourselves from the bullshit. I'm a life coach in Washington, D.C. I have my master's degree in positive psychology, which is the science of human thriving. And, you know, I think that life is pretty fucking spectacular. So that is how this podcast was born. And the purpose is every episode to examine life and examine some element of life that is ultimately miraculous, but also to get into the weeds about how we can liberate ourselves from any bullshit that gets in the way of us recognizing and experiencing each and every day as a miraculous and profound gift, because that is what it is. So today we are actually doing a part two. A few weeks ago, we responded to a really poignant letter from a couple, in which the woman in the couple was African American and the man was Caucasian. And I invited my colleague and friend Huma Sikander to come and speak to us about how to navigate interracial relationships, because she did her master's capstone on this topic and is a psychotherapist who has a great deal of insight on interracial relationships. And there was just so much to say in response to that letter that it felt really important to continue talking about the subject. And I personally, as someone who is in an interracial marriage, am particularly interested and eager to hear all of the insight and sort of wealth of knowledge that Huma has to share. So we are digging deeper into that question of how to navigate interracial relationships today. And as always, the amazing studio engineer Alexia Brown is here with us as well. And I hope that she too will weigh in. So welcome, Huma. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Yay. So, I mean, I have a lot of questions for you. I guess, and I feel like, you know, I'm excited about the response to the letter last time. To me, some of the main takeaways were identifying as a we instead of just two I's, and not seeing problems in a relationship as like one person's problem. I also talked about the necessity of, in any relationship, interracial or not, but more opportunities perhaps to do this in an interracial relationship, of siding with family siding with your partner in the face of disagreement with family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's a piece of research that I thought was important, which basically means like if there ever is a disagreement between your family of origin and your partner or your spouse, if you want the relationship with your spouse to thrive, you have to take a stance and say that you are on your spouse's side. So those are some things that I thought were interesting that we talked about last time. But what I'm really curious about is, Huma, because you did your capstone on interracial relationships, you've been doing therapy with interracial couples. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious, about two things. Basically, A, what are the similarities between interracial couples and all other couples? I'm assuming a lot. But B, perhaps most importantly, what are the findings that you have about issues and, you know, challenges and even like wonderful things? Like, what are the things that are unique mm-hmm. to the experience mm-hmm. of an interracial couple in your findings?
Right. So I think you hit the nail on the head that there's so much that's in common with interracial couples and other couples, right? Because at the end of the day, it's a relationship. So
right.
all of those issues that you struggle with and can come up in any relationship, such as communication or negotiating boundaries with family or mm-hmm. trust and fidelity, all of those things do happen in interracial right.
couples. They're still relevant.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's almost as if there is an extra layer of complexity mm-hmm. that couples need to navigate. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if we just even talk about communication issues, right? Mm-hmm. Like in some cultures, there is this culture of sweeping things under the rug mm-hmm. and not talking about them, mm-hmm. right? So if that is the culture that you've grown up with, where you didn't grow up in an environment where you were, you know, invited to share what you were experiencing, what you were feeling about situations, fights happen and conflicts happen, and then everybody pretended everything was okay mm. afterwards.
Right.
So in a lot of the Asian cultures, that might be the thing.
Sort of like, I think I'm familiar with that as avoidant conflict style.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if that's the kind of communication that you've seen happen around conflicts, then you might bring that into the relationship. Right. Right? And for somebody who's grown up in a very different environment, that might be very different.
Mm. Fascinating.
Right. And then the other thing with communication can also be kind of gender expectations around communication,
mm.
right? So if you've grown up in a South Asian culture or a Southeast Asian culture, there might be this expectation that men keep a very tough exterior, do not share a lot about their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you pair up with somebody who's grown up maybe, you know, in a different culture and maybe, you know, in a white family, for mm-hmm. instance, in a Caucasian family, then they're your partner might not have that expectation, might have different expectations of you.
Right. So, like expect, for example, their husband to be more emotionally communicative.
Right. So mm-hmm. if you've seen, for instance, if you've grown up in a Caucasian family, you've seen your dad very expressive with his emotions, your mom and dad having conversations that were open and honest about everything,
mm-hmm.
then it might be really puzzling to you why your husband now or your partner is not sharing what they're really feeling about things and
right.
just clamping up and not sharing when they're struggling at work, not sharing when they're struggling with family issues and they're just kind of trying to figure them out on their own as the head of the family and as, you know, the person who's the provider and
right.
is supposed to have all the answers, right?
This is very fascinating. This is very fascinating. The first thing that you said reminds me of a piece of research that I talk about with clients a lot on conflict styles.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they talk about conflict styles as like the as a couple, as a unit, you have this conflict style. But the way that I heard it taught by John Gottman, the relationship psychologist, was that each individual has a conflict style, and the three conflict styles are avoidant, validating, and volatile, which is like somewhat mm-hmm. self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that alone, no one conflict style is inherently bad, but that it is very hard to have a successful relationship with somebody who has a different conflict style
right.
from you.
Right.
And
culture plays into that so
right.
much, right? In terms of there are certain things and cultural messages that you grew up with which are very unintentionally internalized.
Right.
And it's only when you're in an interracial relationship, for a lot of people, it's only at that moment that they start realizing how much they've internalized
yeah.
culture.
You know, that's so, I mean, like something that I'm thinking about in this moment that I never, ever thought about before is that because of course, when you talk about this, I think about my own relationship. I grew up in a big Sicilian family, and
we're very loud and expressive.
Right.
And definitely in my family, you know, I was so relieved. As you can tell, I love the work of John Gottman. Like, one of the first lines in his books is about how loud screaming matches do not indicate that a relationship is bad. And mm-hmm. and couples that are very successful and very much in love also have loud screaming matches. But what I'm aware of is that, you know, my husband, who's an African man, frankly, is much more comfortable with loud screaming matches than most of my white friends.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that's just like a very, it would have never occurred to me that maybe my communication style is more compatible with people who don't necessarily identify as Caucasian.
Right.
Because I think there's like many cultures within white culture.
Absolutely.
And I've only recently realized like how important it is for me to own that, like, I am a white person and identify as white, even though what I see myself as is Italian, mm-hmm. you know, but mm-hmm. I also recognize that I am also white and therefore I benefit from white privilege.
Right.
So that is important to me to own and be aware of. At the same time, you know, I don't connect with the way that a lot of white people communicate. Mm. So that thing that you just shared is very interesting to me. Continue.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you said that, you know, at this point in your life and you feel like it's very important for you to sort of be aware of identifying as a white person and be aware of the privileges that come with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great segue into talking about some of the unique challenges that interracial couples experience.
I would love that.
So one of the unique challenges is that, you know, one person in the relationship might be benefiting from a higher social status than the other one and social privileges than the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the times that inherently in itself is not problematic. That's more a societal issue rather than for that couple to tackle with it than themselves. But not having awareness about that difference in socioeconomic status and social status, that in itself can be really problematic. Because if you get into an interracial relationship and you've never really noticed the difference between how society responds to you as a white person or response to people of color, then you're going to be shocked at a lot of points when you walk out with your partner who's a person of color and you're not being given that preferential treatment or people are engaging in microaggressions, right?
Right, or worse, if your partner, and I've heard people express this too, that if they are a person of color and they're in a relationship with a white person, sometimes it feels to them like their white partner doesn't even notice.
Right. Which is another side of the spectrum.
Right.
And equally problematic.
Hey, Alexia, I am interested to get your way in here because I feel like this is kind of what we were talking about off air before the show. Thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are 100%. I think it's super frustrating. And it's something that I've mentioned, I think, in a way previous episode that you had, Sarah, of like, being in a relationship with someone who is Caucasian, I'm speaking from my personal point of view as a woman of color, and for them to not even be cognizant of the microaggressions and the privilege that they have and the things that I am experiencing while they're there and them not being my advocate is something that is such a struggle. And then you as a person of color in the relationship, you have to think about, and this goes back to the other episode that you had with Huma about, like, is it my responsibility? Like, do I always have to carry this responsibility?
Right.
And being in a relationship with someone, you want them to ease the burdens and to be your advocate and to do some of that on your behalf. But I struggle with, like, is that right? You know, like, is that a fair thing to ask of them?
Mm.
Yeah.
Really? Why would it be unfair, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. It's just a question I wanted to put out in the air, but
yeah.
It feels like a very heavy burden. And admittedly, it's something that I think every person of privilege should want to take on, is to be an advocate. But I think when you're in a relationship with someone and you want to, obviously you have burdens together, but you don't necessarily want to overburden that person. Like, yeah. Do I feel comfortable even bringing this to them and putting it on them? And so that's something that I personally think about. I don't know about anyone else, but
yeah, no, I mean, Huma, I feel like that fits in with some of what you were telling me about in terms of like the burden and the shame.
Right.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. You brought that up, Lexia, because, you know, one of the things that happens, is in that moment when you're experiencing a microaggression, there, you do care about this other person, and you know the person cares about you, your partner you're with, and there could be this element of almost shame in bringing up these realities that you live with, and almost this hesitation and shame, like, if I tell this person that I go through this every day, and this mm-hmm. this is like a difficult thing that I'm going to bring into our lives just because of who I am, there can be hesitation and shame associated with that. And that's not a shame in terms of you feeling shameful of who you are, but just in terms of feeling that, you know, you're bringing in this thing that this person will need to deal with for the rest of their life because they're with you, as mm-hmm. opposed to being with a white person or yeah. being with someone else. So what happens with, you know, we were talking about this in the last episode too, about how shame can be such a paralyzing and such a disconnecting emotion in couples.
Right.
So when one partner is experiencing shame, just like you described, Alexia, just you feel kind of shut down and you feel hesitant to engage.
Right.
And you know, there's this flip side to it too, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. But so what happens is, you know, you're self-silencing yourself when you're noticing these microaggressions. And even in situations where, you know, the microaggression is recognized by your partner, there can still be an invalidation that they're doing to further feed into that shame that you're experiencing. They could be like, oh, it wasn't that bad. Or, oh, why couldn't you just speak back to this person and put them back in line? You know, they could be, instead of empathizing, offering solutions, right. which then further feeds into, oh, you don't know how to handle this. It's not a problem of, you know, the environment we were in, but you didn't know how to handle this. Let me tell you how to handle this, you know?
Yeah.
Which that's is real. So problematic.
Yes, that's very real.
Yeah.
So you're saying that the white partner might say that to their partner mm-hmm. of color and basically imply that it's their fault?
Mm-hmm. That they need to do a better job of like standing up for themselves or advocating for themselves. Wow. Or
so that sounds very hurtful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can also be kind of shutting down
right.
for the person of color in the relationship, where it's like, okay, I am not able to get empathy when I discuss this with my partner. It leads to more conflict. So I'm right. already upset about the microaggression, and now I'm having to defend myself to my partner and make them see my point of view, and I almost feel criticized.
Right.
So all of those things combined is just not a good situation.
Right.
So that's, you know, going back to what you were saying, like, that can be an issue if the person, like the Caucasian person, or even I wouldn't even say just white person, but even within people of color, there's differences in the microaggressions they face. There's sure. differences in their experiences.
Totally.
Right? Like me as a Muslim brown woman can't possibly completely fathom what Alexia goes through
right.
as an African American female.
Right.
So even within people of color, when there's interracial relationships, there can be this whole cycle playing out of invalidation and shame and shutting down and disconnecting. So there has to be, you know, when you're in an interracial relationship, it It's something that challenges your racial, your awareness of your racial identity in a very strong way.
How so?
So your partner, for one, is constantly going to, in these situations, challenge you to accept that your experience is different.
Right. Yeah, because it's not a shared experience.
Right. Mm-hmm. So your partner is going to be challenging you, and then society is going to be challenging you. And in ways of, why are you with this person as opposed to somebody from your own race? Mm-hmm. And does that mean you don't like your race? Does that mean you are idolizing the dominant race? Like, what does, why are you with a white person? Why are you with a non-Muslim? What does that mean about you? Are you no longer a Muslim? Are you no longer...
Right. Are you doing that because you don't like yourself and you don't like us and you don't like your family and like the people that you come from?
Right.
Alexia, you were talking about this before the show. Can you share the example that you shared with us?
Yeah, definitely. So I don't remember names. I don't pay attention to sports, but an NBA player recently posted for Valentine's Day a shout out to his girlfriend. He is African. His girlfriend is white. And so my friend had screenshotted this post on Instagram and sent it to me with the comments and explained to me that in the comments, there were a lot of black identifying women just saying less than savory things about his post, mostly in the sentiment of like, oh great, like here's another black man with a white woman,
right?
So my friend who's white was like, can you help me to understand what this reaction is? And so we were talking before the show, and just from my experience, and then Huma brilliantly led me to the fact that there's research that backs this up, that I think that people of color in the United States, whether I think it's all subconsciously, but whether we recognize it or not, is something that I really struggle with. But I think that we all aspire in some way subconsciously to be adored, to be recognized, to be affirmed and validated by white people.
Right.
So that manifests in wanting to be in a relationship with a white person. And once you do get to that point, like, it's amazing. You've reached the apex. You are now, you have now gained status and recognition in society. And so I think that that is something that a lot of people of color struggle with. And then that search for that validation from a white partner can sometimes manifest in self-hate at the same time, because you're also trying to reject all of those things about you, particularly your race and how you identify, and those things that aren't socially acceptable.
Right. Right. Wow. Thank you for sharing, Alexia.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, and just, you know, going back to what you're saying, it's just, it's, it is absolutely a stage of identity development that, you know, person of color goes through. When you grow up in an environment where the dominant race is idealized,
right,
there is an element of internalizing that at some level in your identity development. And what that looks like is, you know, wanting to be friends with white people, wanting to be recognized by white teachers, wanting to be in relationships with white people, and almost not even, almost not recognizing that you are a person of color, and internalizing the racist views of society in terms of seeing it as a hierarchy. Okay, this is the dominant superior race of white people, and people of color are inferior, and almost internalizing that. So that, that is something that could be playing into your attraction to a white person. I hesitate to say that we can say that's exactly what's happening.
Of course, right? Yeah.
Because, you know, the person, we don't want to play into the narrative that a person is their race only, right?
Yeah.
They're a person in themselves. But that is a very real thing that happens. And it's, and I think being in an interracial relationship, you are confronted with that question.
Right.
So you are confronted with that question from your friends and family, and it is, I think, a question worth pondering over.
And what how is the question?
The question that, how do you feel about your own race?
Right.
You know? And it is, it's a question that brings up a lot of dissonance. I mean, it's a you know, you can have, obviously, because you are a certain race, you're going to have your family from that race and all of these people that you love and care about from that race. But, you know, for some folks, I mean, if they are a rebellious identity in itself, that also plays into rebelling from your own race and idolizing the dominant race.
Right.
Depends on where you grew up, what part of the United States you grew up, right? What were the standards that were upheld as somebody being superior?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me to talk about this. And like, I think the more of life that I experience, the more aware I become. And, you know, like what it means to be a white person in a relationship with a black person and becoming aware of that status that Alexia talked about. You know, I was talking about this with my husband the other day. He always jokes that, like, you know, when we like get dressed up and stuff, he's amazing. And he's like, he's a yoga teacher and a philosopher, but he's like a very humble soul, you know, spiritually, financially, you know, all of that. And so he always jokes, he's like, when people see me with you, they're gonna think I'm like this like wealthy man because you're like beautiful and curvaceous. And then I was talking to him about it the other day. I was like, yeah, and because I'm white, mm-hmm. you know. And I don't think he was even, I think like subconsciously he knows that, mm-hmm. but he, like, I don't think he was even thinking about that.
Right.
But I realized that, right. you know, and I realized that that feels good. Yeah. I benefit from that. Mm-hmm. Like when people see me with my husband, they sort of, I get like this, affirmation almost, you know, of like, oh, like you are a beautiful white woman. And that's not, I don't think that I would get the same response, like being with him, you know? So to the point that Alexia is making, and like, I think that, so the other day, my nephew, who my husband and I take care of, he's in the third grade. He came home and he told me that he was telling his friend about me. And his friend was like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. You have a white person in your family. He's like, this is amazing, you know. And he goes, my mom only wants me to marry a black woman. And he's like, so he was like so curious about me, right? His friend. And my nephew is so funny. My nephew goes, he goes, yeah. And I didn't even tell him about all the other white people. yeah. But anyway, I listened to that. And like, I think that, and then like, since like, I know this friend and these families, and like, it's interesting to me because I totally understood that, you know, if I were an African or African American mom, I would want to also teach my children that black women are equally as valuable and as beautiful and as precious and as like high status as white women, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And like that is a real thing. Like there's a reason, like Kim Kardashian, right, is this goddess that's just worshipped, right? And like she's beautiful, she has a beautiful face, she has a beautiful body, and also she has white skin. You know, like she may identify as a woman of color. I know that her father is
Armenian,
yeah. Right. But like when I look at her, I see a white person. Like that's just the truth. And so I mean, it's just, it's clear to me that in society, this is a thing that is happening. And, you know, now that I'm parenting children who are black children, it just feels that much more important to me that as a white person who is in that role, I understand and like help them to understand their value mm-hmm. and their worth and the value and worth of other people who look like them.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I guess like I wonder, to me, being a person who is not a person of color in a relationship with someone who is requires some level of sort of like seeing that other people are facing bigger issues than you.
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. imagine if I were to be offended because my nephew's mom said, because he like innocently revealed that his mom doesn't want him to marry a white person.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
like rather I can already see that my 8-year-old nephew is noticing and making comments about who has lighter skin, right? And that,
yeah,
and that breaks my heart. And I value black females who preach to their family, I want you to embrace yourself, and embrace me,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And embrace us. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, to me, that is important. But also, if something doesn't go as planned, to be able to see the human being in front of you as opposed to just the ethnicity of that person. Alexia, I'm interested in your thoughts on my experience of this as a white girl.
I mean, there's not much I can say except that I really appreciate you sharing this. It's just always encouraging to me to hear white people reflecting yeah. and understanding their role in, especially within a relationship, their role in how their partner feels as a person of color, how they're validated in a really real and meaningful way,
right.
rather than what we were talking about before with, you know, bringing up a microaggression and them trying to help you troubleshoot it or something.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact that we can have you in this space to have the conversation, I think says a lot.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's really amazing to hear you say that, Sarah.
Well,
and just, I mean, it is absolutely something that happens at a very young age. And
yes,
in early development, you know, you start internalizing society's racism.
Right.
As, you know, status quo. Like
right.
there is a hierarchy and you start internalizing that. And that is particularly even more if you're growing up in an area where all you're seeing around you is white people and mm-hmm. people of color, children of color internalize it, white children internalize it. And then that's where the role of parenting for us comes in terms of, you know, you have to be helping them challenge that
mm-hmm.
and see what's wrong in that. And you're doing a wonderful job with them in explaining how a black African-American female is valuable and beautiful and, you know, should have the same social status that any white woman does, and that they should be desiring both,
right?
Right. And valuing both. And that's something that me and my husband were talking about yesterday, and it was something that I've been struggling with is, you know, there's a new definition of racism that progressives are recently talking about, which mm-hmm. is that It's prejudice plus power is the definition. So what it says is that prejudice when prejudice power. Is backed by institutional flow that empowers a privilege for one and a disadvantage for the other, then that's called racism, mm-hmm. right? So what they're doing is they're moving away from the individualistic definition of racism, which is I have prejudice against you, for instance, and I act on it, and that's racism. And what they're saying is that no, racism is if I act on my prejudice with you and if I am in a position of privilege, then it's racism. And, you know, I think people are still struggling with figuring out that whole situation, because what you're doing is you're taking away personal accountability for racist acts almost, because you're saying if you have prejudice against someone and you act on it,
mm-hmm.
because there isn't a system backing you up in terms of disadvantaging that person, you will not be that will not be considered racist. It'll just be considered a prejudice. So if I, as a brown female, I do not, but I'm just saying hypothetically.
Yes, yeah.
I'm just explaining it hypothetically. If I, as a brown female, have prejudice against African-American males, for instance, then if I act on that prejudice, it will not be considered racism because there's no structure in place institutionally for brown people to disadvantage African-American males, which blows my mind.
Interesting. So also debatable, right?
Right. Debatable and interesting. So my struggle with that is that it makes it okay. It's needed in the time right now, I think, because it helps white people understand what needs to be done. So a lot of times white people would say, I'm not acting on my prejudice against any person of color, so I'm not engaging in racism, right? And that helps them say, I'm not engaging in racism, I'm doing my job. And that helps them distance themselves from the task of challenging the institutionalized racism.
Right.
So what this definition helps with is helps them realize that only withdrawing your act, your individual act, is not enough. You have to be challenging institutional racism to be doing your part, right? And it empowers people of color to be able to challenge people within those institutions to say, you need to give preferential or affirmative action to sort of address this institutional racism.
Right.
So it's the definition that maybe is needed for the time being.
Interesting.
But how does that translate into parenting is what's lost on me.
Right.
How do you teach a brown child about going around in the world with equity, with values of equity and equality with regards to race, if you're telling them that, you know, you don't play a part in this because you don't have enough privilege to disadvantage someone? So, I mean, how does that translate into parenting?
And I've never even heard this definition.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading about it. So actually, Jada Smith had on her Red Table Talk had a episode recently about white privilege and racism. And one of the activists over there who's a black female was talking about this. And it was the first time that I had heard about it, too. But then I started reading up on it. And it's something that's gaining stride in progressive circles. And I think my concern with that is the flip side of the situation where we were talking about the racial identity development, and there is a identity development stage that people go through where you start to hate the dominant, sort of hate the dominant and, you know, idealize your own race, right?
Mm.
And
that's the stage after idealizing the dominant.
Right, right. So you're, you know, confronted with a lot of situations where you face the reality that, oh, I'm not as privileged as white people, and no matter what I do, my skin color will always play a part in how I'm seen. And you sort of realize that, okay, you become really resentful of white people for the fact that, you know, you're trying to be nice to them, you're trying to be their friend, you're trying to spend time with them, and they're not treating you. And this could all be
happening at the same time as you're in a relationship with somebody who may be white.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, being aware of your own racial identity is such a strength in an interracial relationship, because then you've already navigated all of these challenges.
Like, go through the stages before you get into an interracial relationship.
Right.
It sounds like you're suggesting. I have a question. Is there a way to sort of like guide yourself through the stages, kind of like force the process, if you will? Or is this something that just happens subconsciously?
I think everybody, as you know, as part of going through identity development in undergraduate school or going through community college or going through employment, I mean, I think one of the things that you can do is start conversing with people who look different from you. Forcing yourself to have relationships in terms of not just romantic relationships, but friends and acquaintances who are different from you.
Right.
So if you're a person of color, having those relationships with, you know, white people. If you're an African American, having those relationships with brown people, with white people, with Southeast Asian people. Mm-hmm. Like, I think just those relationships bring those questions so much to the forefront for your identity development.
Right.
So the first thing you can do is check yourself. Like, yes, I'm getting into a relationship with this person who looks white, but do I have white friends? Do I have any other racial diversity in my group and circle? Or is this the first time that I am interacting with a white person and I'm so now infatuated and want to marry this person?
And same for the white person.
Right. So I think that could be something that obviously fast tracks that identity development piece.
Right.
The other thing that I'll say is kind of read up on things. I think everybody should encourage their kids to be taking courses in whatever institution they're a part of that have to do with, you know, social justice and social equity and races and classes and making sure that your kids are reading about this and you yourself are reading about this. So I think influencing friends to take classes about social justice, I think those classes really sort of push you to examine your own identity. I mean, just going through grad school, I mean, I could see how it was an environment that felt more safe for a lot of people of color than other environments do. And, you know, a lot of us felt very safe in voicing our opinions loud and clear. And it did create a lot of dissonance for a lot of white people in class.
Right. And so as those white people, like, taking that in and allowing yourself to examine your identity and... it sounds like as a white person getting into a relationship with a person of color, that should also be a process that you take yourself through and that you're open to. I have a question, Huma. So we talked about, and I know we have to wrap up, but we talked about this shame cycle and with what Alexia brought up and the person of color maybe feeling shame for bringing this burden and this stressor into their partner's life, but then also the partner who is not a person of color maybe also feeling stressed, or even if they are a person of color but it's just a different color, also feeling stress if maybe their family or people around them are not behaving in ways that are loving and respectful and embracing of their partner who is a different ethnicity. Can you give us any tips about how to break the shame cycle?
So you know, with any situation where one of the partners is going through shame, the one thing that really needs to happen is we need to be constantly asking ourselves when we're in any relationship, am I creating a safe environment for my partner to be sharing their innermost secrets and innermost emotions with me? So if you are noticing that you went out and there was a microaggression and your partner tried to say something or a confrontation happened, or didn't happen. If you're noticing that your partner is now shut down, withdrawn, in their own head, in their own thoughts, you need to reach out and ask them, you know, are you feeling safe right now to share what you're experiencing?
Right.
What can I do to make you feel safe to share with me what you're thinking right now?
Right.
Did I do something to make you feel not safe to share this?
And should both partners be doing this?
I think the partner who's feeling frozen with the shame and feeling paralyzed with the shame, it'd be harder for them to do that. But I think at different points, you might find yourselves on different sides of the coin. So, you know, you might notice at some points you're feeling paralyzed and frozen. And at other points, you know, your partner's feeling paralyzed and frozen. But anytime you notice your partner kind of in their own head, disconnected, sometimes we can go through our own internal process where we're feeling like, oh my God, I'm not good enough. They're going to break up with me. And you can get paralyzed with so much of your own fear and anxiety around what's going on and feeling my partner doesn't love me is why they're withdrawing. You need to ask yourself, have I made my partner safe?
Right.
In terms of them feeling and expressing their emotions.
God, that sounds so hard. Like, so the question that's coming up, and maybe we have to answer it next time, but the question that's coming up is like, if the partner, let's say one of the partners is white, or even South Asian, and they are the one shutting down because they feel shame because their family is not accepting their partner who's, let's say, black.
Mm-hmm.
How is their black partner supposed to help them feel safe? You know what I mean? It seems kind of unfair.
Right. So there's the thing, right? Like, if you're going to tackle that situation as a couple, you have to have open and honest conversations about it.
Right.
There has to be space for both people's emotions.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So absolutely one person's pain in that situation is more, where this is part of a theme that they've lived with for their entire life of feeling the prejudice against them and realizing all of these microaggressions against them. Their pain is greater.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do by invalidating your partner's pain, the white person's pain, is only create more distance between you.
Wow.
You are playing into what their family wants you to do.
Right.
Right. Their family wants you to break up. Their family wants you to disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
By invalidating and not creating space for your white partner's emotions, you are enabling that.
Mm.
So I know it's hard. I know it's hard to get away from your own pain and be able to ask, how was this for you? I know this sucks for me. And I've spent like 1 hour venting about it.
Right.
But how was this for you? What are you thinking?
Right. Wow. Wow. Well, that is powerful stuff. We have to wrap up, but I want to summarize what I've taken away. And Huma, maybe you can add in anything that you think should be in this summary. But my number one takeaway is about conflict styles. Conflict style influences how easy it is to interact in a relationship, and that the way each of us navigates conflict often has a lot to do with our culture and how we were raised. The second thing that feels relevant and like stands out to me is this concept of a shame cycle that Huma introduced me to, whereby in an interracial relationship, often one person will experience shame, or even both people at the same time, because of the racial dynamic. Either the partner of color experiencing shame because of the burden that that puts on their partner, or the partner who is not a person of color experiencing shame because of how people who look like them treat their partner and cause pain for their partner. And then that shame can cause both parties to shut down.
And that
the antidote to the shame is to create space for everyone's feelings and to allow your partner to feel comfortable enough to share, regardless of what side of the experience they're on. And that without that space and that safety to share emotions, the relationship will begin to disintegrate. So those are the two main things that I take away. And then just this dynamic of race in our society and what race, that like racial identity development is a thing for people of color and for white people. And that if you are in an interracial relationship, you must engage in racial identity development.
Right.
You can't just ignore race.
Yes.
So Huma, did I miss anything that
you
seems
got
essential?
It all in there. Yeah, that was a great summary.
Alexia, anything else you want to throw in there?
I do not. It was a good episode, guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you, Alexia, for sharing. No,
thanks
you, Huma, for being here.
Yeah.
I mean, I always feel like there's more to say on this subject. I want to talk more about the family stuff, but I hope that all of you listening gain something from this, whether you're in an interracial relationship or not. And I think listening to this, I also think of how all of this applies to also interracial friendships.
So absolutely.
Thank you for listening and have a miraculous day.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.